טוב, שלום עליכם. Let us begin. Some of you at least will have a Gemara. Talmud Bavli, Masechet Kefir Bof. In which case, please open it up. Daf Kof. Kof Yod Amud Beth. The Mishnah states in Masechet Ketubot Kof Yod Amud Bet, in the middle of the page, more or less, we have the Mishnah: Hakol Ma'alin La'aretz Yisrael Wa'en Hakol Mosi'in, Hakol Ma'alin Yerushalayim Wa'en Hakol Mosi'in, Ehad Ha'anashim Wa'ehad Hanashim. Rashi explains: Hakol Ma'alin Et Kol Bnei Vetho Adam kofe la'alot v'leshev imo b'Yerushalayim. Ehad ha'anashim, ehad ha'anashim. Af ha'isha kofa et ba'ala la'alot v'ladur sham. Ve'im lo, you'll see, we then ketuba, kede katane be'baraitha b'gmura b'hedya. All right, so what is this Mishnah saying? If a Jewish couple, a man and a woman, are married and living in Chutz Laretz. And obviously, if both of them decide they wish to move to Eretz Yisrael, there's no problem. But what if only one of them wants to move to Eretz Yisrael and the other doesn't want to move? The Mishnah states that either spouse may force the other to go to Eretz Yisrael because one of them wants to. In other words, whether it's the husband who's interested in moving to Eretz Yisrael and the wife is not, or vice versa, either one can say to the other, you have to accompany me to Eretz Yisrael. Now what happens if, nevertheless, shall we say, the wife does not want to accompany her husband to Eretz Yisrael? So the Mishnah states that is the din of the Mishnah. Later on we find in the Gemara, in the few lines down, in the Gemara, the second of the wide lines in the Talmud, it's that the Baraita states, Tano Rabbanan, Hu Omer La'aloth, Wehi Omereth Shelo La'aloth, he wishes to move to Eretz Yisrael, she does not wish to do so, Kofin Otha La'aloth, she may be forced to do so. Now what does that mean? You can't force her if she really doesn't want to. And if she does not want to, if she insists upon remaining in Chutz La'aretz, ve'im lo teseh b'lo ketubah, then she runs the risk, if the husband chooses to do so, he can divorce her, give her a get, and not pay her ketubah. She forfeits her ketubah, which certainly in ancient times, and also in many cases today as well, but without a doubt in ancient times even more so, this placed the woman in a very difficult position. It was very often extremely difficult for a woman alone to fend for herself and to make a living, etc. So this is a very serious sanction. Okay, it's something which, it's more or less an offer that you can't refuse, right? But it's not one way, it's a two-way street. He omereth la'aloth, continues the Baraita. Wahu omer shelo la'aloth, she is the one who wants to move to Eretz Yisrael. Kofin otho la'aloth, he also may be forced. What do you mean kofin? The Beth Din tells him, if he goes to the Beth Din and says, look, you know, my wife is causing trouble, she wants to go to Eretz Yisrael, which is a terrible thing, of course, whatever. No, but it is a serious issue. It's not a laughing matter. We'll see in a moment. There can be all kinds of reasons why a person does not want to or feels he can't do so. He goes to the Beth Din, shall we say, and complains. The Beth Din says, look, she's in the right. You have to agree to pick up and move to Eretz Yisrael. And if, nevertheless, you really do not wish to do so, then and she insists on going no matter what. We'll see, we tend ketubah. The Beth Din tells him, then in that case, you have to give her a get and her ketubah. She does not forfeit her ketubah because she wants to do a miswa. She wants to do something which is correct and proper and required, as we discussed last week. And for whatever reason you can't or don't want to or refuse, so you have to give her a get and allow her to go to Eretz Yisrael, and you also have to give her ketubah, which may be a very substantial amount of money. The Baraita continues, by the way. This is already brings us on to the other side of the coin, which we also wish to touch upon this evening, and that is the opposite case. We have a couple who live in Eretz Yisrael, and for different reasons, one of them wishes to leave Eretz Yisrael. All right. So the Baraita says, "He omereth laseth." She wishes to leave Eretz Yisrael. Rashi says, "Laseth Yerushalayim legvulin." In other words, either talking about leaving Yerushalayim to move to another part of the country, or to leave Eretz Yisrael altogether to move to Chutz Laaretz. Because we saw in the Mishnah two concepts. One was moving from La'aloth, from Chutz Laaretz to Eretz Yisrael, and the other one was La'aloth from any other part of the country to Yerushalayim, which is considered preferable and higher or greater miswa than other parts of the country. So the opposite is also the case. If he says, let's move to Tzfat and let's leave Yerushalayim, or vice versa, he omeret laseth, says the Baraita, who omer shelo laseth, kofin otha shelo laseth. She is told, well, you can't force your husband to leave Eretz Yisrael or to leave Yerushalayim to move somewhere else in the country. And if you insist, then he can give you a get, and he does not have to pay your ketubah. And the opposite is also true. He's the one who wants to leave. Alright? Now, this halakha, before we even mention who's posek halakha this way, who's or who might not, or what we see in the different posekim, we have to understand, obviously, we have to ask ourselves, why is one side allowed to force the other side to do something they apparently don't want to do? And why does this side who wishes to move to Eretz Yisrael, for example, have the upper hand? So, based on what we saw last week, when we discussed the general miswa, which is actually incumbent upon Klal Yisrael, upon the Jewish people, of Kibush Haaretz and Yerushat Haaretz, and the miswoth which flow from this essential miswa minat Torah as a consequence thereof, namely the miswa of living in Eretz Yisrael and or buying, purchasing land in Eretz Yisrael or a house, etc., as we saw last week, which is what's known as Yishuv Eretz Yisrael or Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael, depending on whether we're talking about one or the other. Obviously, this act of moving to Eretz Yisrael must be a miswa of some kind. Otherwise, if there's no miswa involved, if there's nothing, no definable Torah quantity involved here, then why can the wife say to her husband, I want to go to Eretz Yisrael, I've had enough living here in New York, I want to go to Eretz Yisrael. Why can she say that? If there's no Torah basis, no foundation for what she's saying. Well, if she were to say, for example, to a husband, and they live in New York, I want to move to Paris, then she has no case, right? Or if in London, she wants to move to, Timbuktu, it doesn't matter. She has no case. It's only when she wants to move, or he wishes to move to Eretz Yisrael, that there is a case. It must be, therefore, as the Rashbash, here in this Tshuva here, that we discussed, Rabbeinu Shlomo ben, the son of the Rashbats. Rashbats is Shimon Bar Semach, alright? In this Tshuva, the Rashbash, he makes this obvious point, really. It's self-evident. There has to be a miswa. The miswa, says the Rashbash, as we mentioned him also last week, he explains, he holds the miswa the Jewish people taking control of and dwelling as a nation in Eretz Yisrael is a miswath asemin hatorah, like the Ramban, as we saw last week. He also mentioned, as we mentioned also last week, that his father, the Rashbatz, also took this view. Furthermore, what we see in the Rashbash, I hinted to this, I'll mention it briefly in passing, now we'll mention it more in more detail. The Rashbash actually adds something which you don't find in any other source, or not before his time at least, and that is that the yeshiva, the dwelling in Eretz Yisrael of the individual, is also considered a miswath aseh. In other words, he doesn't see, which you could see, and in fact I tend to see it in that way, that it's a spin-off of from the greater miswa, the general miswa of Yerushat Eretz Yisrael, the inheriting and taking control of and establishing one's presence in Eretz Yisrael on the national scale, and that there is a spin-off, as it were, of this miswa on the individual as well. And there are other examples where we see such a concept. We know that the miswa, for example, of building a Beth Mikdash is a miswa which is incumbent upon the nation. Correct? An individual can't build a Beth Mikdash, it goes without saying. Nevertheless, and the Rambam, just for example, mentions this as an explicit an example of a miswa, the building of the Beth Mikdash, I mean, an example of a miswa which is incumbent upon the klal, upon the nation, and not upon the individual. Nevertheless, we find in the Gemara, and the Rambam quotes, and I'm about to tell you where it is in the Rambam, in the Choth Beth HaBechira, Perek Aleph, as I recall, just a moment. The Rambam says in Hilchot Beth HaBechira, Perek Aleph, Halacha Yod Beth, after he explains in Halacha Aleph, he first said, he began by saying, Miswat Aseh La'asod Bayit Hashem, that's a Miswat Aseh to build a Mikdash, etc., etc. And as we said, common sense dictates, and the Rambam states as much explicitly in Sefer HaMiswot, that this is a miswa which is incumbent upon the nation, not upon the individual. Nevertheless, the Rambam says here in Halacha Yud Beth, "Wahakol hayavim livnoth ulasa'id ba'asman uvimamonam." All Jews, individual Jews, are required to build ulasa'id ba'asman. You can understand it as well as and or all. Probably or is more correct. In other words, either to be involved physically in the building or to donate money to the purpose. Ba'asman uvemamunam, donate money or their own perhaps expertise if they're a builder or an engineer or whatever it is. In other words, every individual is required to take part in this miswa in some way. The Rambam says, "Hakol hayavim livnoth ulasa'id ba'asman uvemamunam anashim v'nashim, men and women, kamikdash hamidbar, as it was in the midbar in the desert in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, where all individual Jews took part in the building of the Mishkan, either by building or by donating, etc." So you see here another example, where you have a miswa, which is explicitly mentioned by the Rambam as a prime example of a miswa, which is incumbent upon the klal, miswath klal, not a miswa of the yahid. But because, if, as we said last week, if everyone decides to say, well, it's a miswa on the klal, so go find the klal, wherever the klal may be hiding, and find the Jewish nation, wherever you might be able to find them, and tell them they have to do it. I'm just little old me. I'm just, you know, Chaim Shmerel. I'm nobody. I'm not required to do this. So everyone were to take that attitude, then obviously nothing would ever get done. And that's exactly why Chachamim stated, and the Rambam quotes, writes him a furash, halacha l'maaseh, so that every Jew has to play his part in making sure this actually happens. There are other examples, but I don't want to go into this issue right now at great length. I'm saying the same thing obviously applies when it comes to Eretz Yisrael, that one could understand, perhaps not exactly as the Rashbash does, that just as the Rambam doesn't say it's a mitzvah aseh min ha-Torah for every individual to donate money to the Mikdash, but the Rambam does say that everyone's required to do so. Why are you required to do so? Because, as we just said, it's a mitzvah for the Jewish nation, and you're part of the Jewish nation. You can't opt out of the Jewish nation and say, the Jewish nation is required, so talk to the Jewish nation, I'm busy today, I haven't got time. That is not an option. That's not a proper and acceptable attitude. The same applies to Aliyah Eretz Yisrael. You can't say it's a Jewish people's problem to live here and do all the things it says in the Torah, but I wish to live elsewhere. I have nothing to do with this miswa, because I'm an individual. I'm just little old me, and it's not incumbent upon me as an individual. That's also not a reasonable response or attitude. The reasonable response is, as the Rambam says, everyone is required to build and to aid and assist and to donate, whatever each person can do to bring this miswa of building the Mikdash to fruition. The same is true of Eretz Yisrael. Every individual is required to do his part. So what's more obvious? What is the most obvious thing that a Jew can do in order to play his part in this great historic endeavor and miswa of Yerushat Haaretz? By being here, first of all. Every Jew who is here strengthens the Jewish nation, strengthens the Jewish nation's hold on the land, etc. Everything he does here to build up the land, to help the economy, whatever it is that he does, even just by being here, you're actually helping the economy in some way. That is, he is playing his role, he is taking part in this great miswa. You could therefore understand that these are spin-offs from the miswa without the actual residing of the individual being considered technically a miswa ta'aseh in itself. But the Rashbash more than once writes, not so. The Rashbash writes here a couple of times, I'll quote you one sentence to this effect. And he's talking about this Mishnah exactly that we just read now about a married couple forcing one forcing the other to move to Eretz Yisrael. He says, "When you're Eli," this is in Siman Aleph in Shulchan Aruch Bash near the beginning. "When you're Eli, shehata'am hu mishum de yeshivat Eretz Yisrael miswahi." Wanafkalan mikra, we learned this from the pasuk that we learned last week. "Dichtiv beretz Yisrael v'rishtem otha v'yishavtem ba." Yes, the sentence I was looking for, where he says explicitly in so many words that he uses the term miswath aseh, which normally means it's a miswa min ha-Torah. He writes, "Shehay yeshiva be'eretz Yisrael miswath aseh bifne asma." Those are his words. The actual residing, the residence of an individual in Eretz Yisrael is a miswath aseh in and of itself. In other words, he's actually giving this act of residing in Eretz Yisrael, this miswa, an explicit, formal status of a miswa tase. So as we said, clearly, if there were no miswa, again, even if one doesn't define it technically as the Rashbash does, as miswat aseh mamash, but if one defines it and sees it as a a logical and basically essential corollary of the miswa, which is incumbent upon the Jewish nation as a whole to live in Eretz Yisrael, and that it therefore follows that individuals also have a role to play in this, as we just discussed from the other example of the miswa of building the Mikdash. However one defines it technically, I don't think that's very meaningful. I think that's a technical issue. It's really not very material whether it's defined technically as miswa tase, the actual yeshiva of the individual or not, because as we said, it goes without saying that this is what the Torah had in mind. It's clear that's what Hashem had in mind, that when he said the Jewish people should be in Eretz Yisrael, he meant the individual should also be here. There's no Jewish nation if all the individuals are not required to do anything. So it's clear there is such a miswa, and on that basis we have this Mishnah. Were it not for that fact, were there no such miswa, says the Rashbash, obviously incorrectly, then there could not be such a miswa. There could not be no halakha that states that a husband has to move to Eretz Yisrael if he didn't really want to because his wife wants to, or vice versa. There couldn't be such a thing. Now, having established that much, we can look at the Tosafot on this very daf, on the middle of the page. Dibur Amathil Hu Omer La'aloth. The Tosafot say, Eino noher bazman hazeh. This din does not apply at the present time. The present time, of course, one has to recall, is not Tafshin Samach Teth in Yerushalayim, not 2008 in Yerushalayim. The present time is somewhere in the 12th century in the north of France or the Rhineland or Germany, right when the situation was very different in every way possible. But the Tosafot say, Eino noher bazman hazeh, de'ika sakanat derachim. This is one statement. There's a second statement of Tosafot, which we'll read also in a moment. So what does this statement say? This halakha does not apply at the present time, when the Tosafot wrote this. Why? Because traveling to Eretz Yisrael today, from, shall we say, where the Tosafot lived, in France, in Germany at that time, was a very hazardous business. There were risks involved in traveling at all, and through certain parts of the world, through certain countries, and the methods of transport, etc., were not what they are today, and there were lawless parts of the world, etc. So it was something which definitely involved risk, serious risk, and therefore, the Chachamim, according to the Tosafot, are explaining, is that this halakha is very important and very wonderful, but if it involves risk to life and limb, then this halakha does not apply. In other words, where sakana, where serious sakana is a real possibility, is a present and constant danger and reality, this halakha was not said in such a time, in such a place. Well, that's an interesting question, and this has to do with other halachot also, whether you can or cannot risk your life for different types of miswot or certain inyanim, etc. But that's what the Tosafot say here. The Rashbash, in this tshuva of his, he has actually the first few tshuvot here in his shoot deal with this and related issues. He actually is the first one, I think, to deal, and he himself writes that he's the first one. In other words, he says, I looked in different posukim, and I did not see any of the posukim really discuss this matter in detail, because he himself writes at the beginning, he says as follows. He says, I decided to look into this matter, lehit bonen bedin ze, to investigate this halakha, kefi kohi, uridrosh, ולתור בספרים בכל מאודי, כפי אשר תסיר ידי, אם העלייה הלזו המחויבת על האיש או האישה, if this מצווה of moving to Eretz Yisrael from חוץ לארץ, היא אפילו כשיש בדבר סכנות מסויות, even when this involves danger, ברכיבת ימים ודריכת מדברות, by traveling on the high seas or crossing deserts, etc. כיוון שדין זה נזכר במשנה וגמרא ובשאר הספרים בלא תנאי ושיעור. In other words, if you look in the usual standard posikim, the Rif, the Rosh, the Rambam, what have you, and others, you do not see they actually deal with this issue. The Tosafot here, as we see, did actually mention it very briefly, just in a few words, but they don't really go into detail into how do you define in which type of situation may a husband force his wife to move to Eretz Yisrael or vice versa. And when can the Beit Din say to the person, look, the situation at the present time in our part of the world, in this point in history, is such that it's a dangerous move and it involves too much danger. How exactly you rate danger, how you weigh danger and quantify it is an interesting issue in itself. But I think it's clear to anyone who knows anything at all about history during the time of the Tosafot and also the time of the Rosh Hashanah, which was later, and taking into account what we know of historical circumstances, etc., and also just the physical realities of traveling in those days, it was clearly not a simple matter. In fact, to say it was not a simple matter is understating the issue. It was a very complicated and very traumatic and likely to be a fairly traumatic experience. So, it's a very real question. Can a wife say to her husband, or vice versa, even though it's likely to be a fairly difficult and risky business, that's what I want to do, we should go and do it. So the Tosafot expressed the opinion, as we just saw, the Rashbash goes into this issue in greater detail, and he agrees, he has actually quoted the Tosafot, interestingly enough, but perhaps in his Tosafot this particular statement didn't exist. And we have other reasons to believe, in fact, that he didn't, that this Tosafot, this Dibur HaMatchil, did not appear in front of all the Rishonim, but that's another issue. And the Rashbash concludes that where there is real danger, a person is not required to do so, not required or cannot be forced to do so.
Force his spouse,
etc. He also states that the miswa of going to Eretz Yisrael from Chutz Laaretz also depends upon being able to find a home to live in and a way of making a living, etc. In other words, if a person believes, not as an excuse, but as a true and sincere opinion. In other words, he weighs up the matter and truly and sincerely reaches the conclusion that he can't possibly do this for certain reasons, then that might also be a valid reason not to take upon oneself such a trip or such a move. So says the Rashbash. He in his words, I quote a few words from the Rashbash, he says, אם לא מסע את ההרון, הרון means that which is fitting, that which he can survive with, that which he can manage with. He can't find the kind of a home or a place to live or what have you. אפילו בלא שלא אינו חייב לעלות עד שימצא את ההרון, until he has some way of real thinking or believing that he's going to be able to go through with this and succeed in what he's doing. So the basic message, therefore, of the Tosafot and the Rashbash is that when the conditions, the political conditions, the security conditions, etc., are such, perhaps also economic conditions, are such that it's a very this endeavor is fraught with real danger, as was the case in this period of history, because one obviously understand. I imagine we all understand that today it's difficult to think of any situation where it's really difficult or dangerous. Difficult it might be in some ways, but dangerous it certainly is not. We're not talking about difficulty. Difficulty is one thing. We're talking about danger, real danger. It's not dangerous to get on a plane if you're anywhere in the world and come to Israel. It's safer than taking a bus. Statistically, that's a fact. More people are injured riding buses or cars than flying airplanes. So it's certainly not a dangerous business to come here today. So this statement of the Tosafot is really, as it says here, Bazman Hazeh. It was relevant in their time, not relevant in our time. And I'm sure, and the Rashbash, of course, would take the same opinion, would take the same position if he were to be alive today and be aware of the present realities. One could ask, and the Rashbash does ask this question, so if that's the case, if it also depends on things such as the danger involved in traveling, then why was this not mentioned by the Chachamim? And his answer is a very simple one, and I think it's also self-evident, but I will read it. And he says, "Ve'im rabotenu zal lo yizkiru tanai zeh shel Talmud nitkan b'fa'at ha-mizrach." If the Talmud doesn't mention this matter of sakana and the dangers involved in traveling, therefore it must be, he says, it's obviously because the Mishnah and the Talmud, etc., the Chachamim, were talking about people who lived in countries near Eretz Yisrael, in the Mizrach, in other words, in the east, in other words, compared to the western more parts of the globe. For instance, people in Bavel, where it was quite normal and definitely possible. After all, you had Oler Galim, people came to the Beit Mikdash during the Zman HaBayit all the time, and we know in general that people traveled a lot from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, or another you could say from Turkey, which is not far from Eretz Yisrael, which is Chutz La'aretz, but it's not very far. And there were many, many Jews living in Turkey, for example. So when the Chachamim spoke about this halacha, or you could also take Egypt as an example, which is another ancient Jewish community, going back to the time of Churban Bayit Rishon, where Jews lived in countries and areas not very distant from Eretz Yisrael, where traveling was quite normal and standard procedure. The Radbaz, a couple of hundred years after the Rashbash, who lived in Mitzrayim, he says that to travel from Yerushalayim to Cairo is a 7-day journey. It's like, you know, you're getting on a bus. It was a camel bus, but it was regular. There was a regular shirut, and it was a well-known route, and it was done all the time, and it took 7 days. So people living in countries near Eretz Yisrael, and also in a period of time when there was no particular danger to be found on the roads. In other words, this could change in a certain period of history, where, for example, the central government was weakened, and they didn't really control the highways, etc. There could be lots of bandits and robbers, and beyond a certain point, you might be justified in saying it's too dangerous to travel at the moment. Right? And that's true that such things did happen, but in the normal way of things, it was possible to travel, to make such a trip from such countries which were near Eretz Yisrael, which is where most of the Jews were at the time when this Mishnah and the Gemara were discussing this halakha. At that time, there weren't many Jews living in Germany or in the United States or in South America or New Zealand. They didn't have such things. And of course, if you did have a Jew living in New Zealand at that time, which you didn't, then it really was impossible to get to Eretz Yisrael. Whereas, by the time the Rashbash or the Tosafot write this statement, we're talking about a much later period in history, about 1,000 years later, where you have many Jews. In fact, by this time, most of the Jews in the world are living in countries quite distant, either somewhat distant or very much distant from Eretz Yisrael. Traveling, by definition, therefore, is a very different thing altogether. It means either a sea journey, which was a dangerous thing in those days. Very often they were not just pirates, just the weather, storms. Ships are not what they are today. Even today, some things can happen at sea, but much less likely today than it was then. Then it was much more common for ships to sink at sea, or a very long and hazardous journey over land, very, very arduous, physically difficult. It could take months, and it could mean traveling through areas which no one really knows how safe it is to go there or not to go there. And we know for a fact there were periods of history when there was very little international travel because of these reasons. The Rambam actually alludes to this in his Hakdamah to Mishneh Torah. He talks about the fact that today when he's writing the Mishneh Torah in the 12th century, according to the Christian calendar, he says the Drachim Mishubashot, in other words, the world is in turmoil, and travel is not what it used to be. The major reason for this, at least in some parts of the world, is because was the collapse of the Roman Empire. When the Roman Empire collapsed in the early part of the 5th century, the great central authority that ruled a very large part of the planet, or the known world at least, in other words, large parts of Europe, basically all of Western Europe and Central Europe, and the Mediterranean basin and the countries around about, and all the way down to Egypt and North Africa. We're talking about a very, very large area. As long as the Roman Empire was functional, and that we're talking about a period of many, many centuries, then there was basically peace. The expression Pax Romana is well known, and it was a fact. The Romans weren't a nice bunch, but they did impose their will, and when they wanted there to be peace, there was peace, because if you didn't play the game by their rules, then they just wiped you out. And those who didn't like Pax Romana had nothing at all. So you either Pax Romana or nothing. But when that ceased to be the case, and the German tribes and others began to overrun the Roman Empire, then that's when the Dark Ages began, and the world was thrown back into a period of history that hadn't existed, into a situation that had not existed for a very, very long time, and international commerce basically ceased, and also many technologies and much knowledge was lost or almost lost, etc., as we know. So these things did change and will change, are likely to change as history changes. So what the Rashbash says is that when the Chachamim spoke about this halacha, they were talking about people who were in a position, living in a country and at a time where it was reasonable and not really such a daunting prospect to make such a journey. To quote the Rashbash, he writes, he also says the reason that the Posekim didn't discuss this in detail is also for the same reason. He says, "B'gama mehabarim shelo iskiru, iskiruhu mehamath shenimshechu aharat Talmud." And what they just wrote down the basic halacha in the Talmud, but Chachamim are supposed to apply their reason and common sense and understanding and wisdom beyond just the bare words of the text. And therefore it was understood, he says, by Chachamim in later periods when the situation became much more hazardous, that this halakha could not be imposed in all places and all times. As he writes, "V'chol ba'al sechel makir shebemakom sakana masuya asur l'saken ba'asmo." Here he writes, one is not allowed, in fact, to risk one's life to do this. That's an interesting point. I don't want to go into it at length, but I will mention that there were, we know, cases, and more than one. We're talking actually many, many cases, hundreds of Chachamim during this period of time, not exactly the very year necessarily the Rashbash wrote this, but during the Middle Ages, came to Eretz Yisrael. Without a doubt, the trip often did involve some risk, and yet they did so. If they considered it to be asur to do so, as long as there was any risk whatsoever, then they wouldn't have done so. So they obviously felt that either the risk was not so great, or one is allowed to take such a risk, up to as long as the risk is not outrageous, not unreasonable. One could also make the point that people regularly risk their lives, literally, to make a living. People do it nowadays also. But people did it then in terms of international commerce, traveling huge distances, bringing, for example, spices and silks from the East, from China, from India, bringing it to the West. Well, that wasn't something that happened very easily. That was a very complicated adventure. A round trip could take a year to the East and back to Germany to bring the black pepper to Germany from India. Go there and back was a year, if you were lucky. It could be longer. And it was also hazardous, and yet people did it to make a living. No one said, well, I'm not going to make a living, or I'm not going to do anything, or you can't make a living because what you're doing is dangerous. In other words, when something's important enough to you, you do take a risk. The question is whether it's a reasonable risk or it's completely foolhardy. To do something completely foolhardy is not what we're discussing. We're discussing something which is possible, which is feasible. Again, it goes without saying that today most of this discussion is academic. As the Rashbash sums up, he says, "V'lo dibru zichronem ivrachan lo zechachamim ela be'efshar, aval be'efshar u'yesh sakana b'davar lo amruhu." So where it's impossible and it's too dangerous, you're not required to do so, and probably most people wouldn't think to do so. And that's also the obvious reason why most Jews, you know, if you take the last 1,000 years, for example, when again Jews were scattered all over the globe, and the conditions were not very often congenial to making such a journey, most Jews didn't do such a thing. So if people ask, as I've heard some people ask, well, if it's such a great mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, it's a silly question, of course, but I'm just stating for the record what I've heard, what some people have said. If it's such a great mitzvah, then why didn't Jews do it always? You know, why did all our forefathers live in Poland or in Hungary or in Morocco? Why didn't they come? So obviously it's not a mitzvah, correct? Well, it's not obvious at all. The answer is that to make a trip from Hungary to Eretz Yisrael 400 years ago, or 800 years ago, or even, for that matter, 100 years ago perhaps it was much more doable, I think, but certainly hundreds of years ago, or 1,000 years ago, it was obviously a very risky thing, and most people are not heroes, let's put it that way, most people are not heroes, and the Torah does not require that every Jew be a hero and above, who always goes well beyond, above and beyond the call of duty. But there is a duty, and the Jew is required to do that as long as it's a reasonable expectation, and it's within his power to do so. Of course, if a person's a bit more motivated, then he'll go the extra mile. And if a person's more motivated still, he'll go some extra miles more. But the average person is going to act like an average person. The average person will not take upon himself major risks at a time when it's not clear how you're going to get there, and it's not clear what you're going to find when you get there, if you get there. So you don't find out. You don't do such things, because most people are not that brave. And it's only in relatively modern times that, perhaps shall we say the last 100 years or even less, that travel over such distances has become much more doable and much more much less hazardous, and also more affordable, by the way. Right? It was also a question of money. Of traveling is also an expensive business. It is today, but it's much less so than it was once upon a time. So this miswah, as great as it is, and we discussed last week how it's dohe amira le'nochri b'shabbat, etc., is nevertheless, like any other part of the Torah, is subject to reason and logic and reality. It's not something which is beyond or above the normal rules of engagement, so to speak, in this world. And therefore, for that very reason, now we move on to the second issue, the question of leaving Eretz Yisrael. The Rambam writes in Hilchot Melachim Perek He, Hilchot Melachim Milchamot, Perek He Halacha Yod. He writes,
I'm sorry, Yod Aleph. He writes, Asur laseth me'aretz Yisrael l'chusra la'aretz le'olam. It is forbidden, always forbidden, in all circumstances, it is forbidden to leave Eretz Yisrael and go to Chutz La'aretz. However, there are exceptions to this rule, says the Rambam. Ela lilmod Torah, unless it's for the purpose of studying Torah, or lisa isha, or to get married, to marry a woman. I think it's obvious. One could, I imagine, it's would be agreed to by all. That the same is also true in the reverse, that for a woman to marry a man, or lehasil miyav hagoyim, or for the purpose of going to Chutz La'aretz to save Jews from goyim who are attacking them, or something needs to be done there which would require you going there to effect this yeshua, this salvation for the Jews. In such circumstances, one is allowed to leave. The Rambam says, "V'yachzol la'aretz," on condition that he returns to Eretz Yisrael. V'chein yoseh hu lishora. Similarly, one is allowed to leave, as we mentioned before. You make a living. You're allowed to leave lishora, on business, right, on a trip, a business trip. Aval lishkon v'chutz la'aretz asur. To live, to reside in Chutz La'aretz is asur. Unless the situation in Eretz Yisrael is very, very dire indeed, there's famine. So that everything is doubled in price. So if a loaf of bread used to cost, for example, 10 shekel, now it costs 20 shekel, in other words, everything is twice as expensive as it was, and you're not able to survive, then you're allowed to leave. Now, you will recall that last week I quoted from the Rambam in this very same perek. In Halakha Zayin, the Rambam says, "Umutar lishkon v'chol ha'olam." It's mutar to reside anywhere on earth, chus mi'eres Mitzrayim, except for Egypt. So, how can the Rambam say in Halakha Zayin it's mutar to live anywhere on earth? And in the very same chapter, four halachot later, in Halakha Yud Aleph, he says, "Aval lishkon v'chus la'aretz asur," but it's forbidden to live in Chutz La'aretz. So, what the Rambam means, from the context, it's clear, and from the sources on which this halakha is based, it is clear. The Rambam means to say, the act of living in Chutz La'aretz, wherever it may be, except for Egypt, is not an avera in and of itself. Therefore, it's mutar. If it's not an avera, it's mutar. The Rambam in Halakha Yud Aleph is not talking about residing in Chutz La'aretz per se. He's talking about the isur of yisi'ah mi'eretz Yisrael, leaving Eretz Yisrael, and moving to Chutz La'aretz. And this whole halakha, and this is very important to understand, this whole halakha is talking about moving away on a permanent or semi-permanent basis. In other words, if a person is living in Eretz Yisrael, and it's a couple, and that's why if it's a couple, then we have the issue that we saw in the Baraita that we quoted before, right? That if he wants to leave the country and she doesn't want to leave, then there's a halachic issue to be dealt with here. Perhaps she has a point. Maybe she can prevent him, or he has to give her a get and a kithuba, etc. But let's say they both want to leave Eretz Yisrael, or a single person. The act of a person who already lives here moving away in order to live elsewhere, that is a very serious thing, and that's asur. That's what the Rambam says again. I read it again. Asur laseth me'eretz Yisrael l'chutz la'aretz le'olam. Unless it's for the following reasons: limod Torah, lisa isha, or lasil miyav goyim, v'yachzol la'aretz, v'chein yoseh l'schoras. So there's four reasons mentioned here in the Rambam. One is to study Torah. The second is to get married. The third is to some act of defending Jews or fighting for Jews in Chutz La'aretz or something like that, and business, and commerce, etc. Now, you have to understand that we're not talking about what's called a business trip today. A business trip today can be getting on an aircraft in Toronto at 8 a.m. for a 10 a.m. Appointment in New York City, and taking the 5 p.m. flight back and getting home for dinner, right? That's a business trip today, correct? It happens all the time. People also go away for 2 weeks sometimes, but people do it sometimes just for a couple of hours, right? They just, you know, just walk on. You don't even have to buy a ticket, just walk on, and it's like a bus, right? all over the world. That's how it works nowadays, but not then. If, as we said before, if it's l'schora, for business, for commerce, he's a merchant, then he didn't leave Tveria at 8 in the morning and come back at 5 in the afternoon. He left Tveria at 8 in the morning in Nisan, and he might be back in 6 months or 8 months or 10 months, or he may never come back. It all depends. It's hard to know. And it depends where he's going. He may be going to Turkey, in which case it's maybe a month round trip. And he may be going to Germany, and in that case, it's anyone's guess, right? But certainly it's months. So moving away, going on a business trip, or the other examples here, we said, Limud Torah. What does it mean, Limud Torah? It's mutar to go to chutz la'aretz limud Torah. So what does it mean, Limud Torah? For 5 minutes, do you go, you cross the border to hear a shiur, and you step back over the border 5 minutes later or 5 hours later? That's not what we're discussing. We're talking about a person, for example, in those days. Again, you have to think, it's very important, this is a very fundamental thing that I wish you all to understand and internalize. And many people somehow are blissfully unaware of this very obvious thing, it's very self-evident fact. Chazal, in the Mishnah, in the Talmud, etc., and the Rambam, who's quoting these sources directly, without, in these cases, adding very much of his own, are, of course, speaking about their own reality, their own context, historical context. So when would a person leave Eretz Yisrael to study Torah? For example, in the 5th century, when there was heavy persecution of Jews in Eretz Yisrael by the Byzantines, and the yeshivot were closed, and for all sorts of reasons, many Jews were living in the country. And a Jew wants to go to Bavel, where the Jews were living in relative peace and calm, and there were great yeshivot and teachers of Torah in Bavel. And this young man wants to go to Bavel to study Torah. He's not going to go for 5 minutes or 5 hours. He's not going to go for 5 weeks either, because it takes him probably a month to get there. He's going to go for a long period of time, months or years, right? If he really wants to study Torah seriously. You know, this is how he where he sees himself, how he sees himself spending his life, or he wants to focus on this for the next few years. That means he's going to go to Bavel and spend the next 3, 4, 5, or 15 years there. Correct? The Rambam is saying it's mutar to do that as long as you return to Eretz Yisrael afterwards. But even if it's a very lengthy stay, if it's for the purpose of studying Torah, it's mutar. Similarly, if Lisa Isha, to get married, also, it's not a 5-minute affair or a week-long journey. We're talking about a lengthy matter. Why? Because if, for example, even if it was set up in advance by way of letters or some prior arrangement, very often in those days it was the norm, it was the custom that, let's say, a man came from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel to marry a woman that would have been offered or had been arranged that he was going to marry this woman. The woman's family would often not agree that he would just take her away now to Eretz Yisrael and they would never see her again, because that's really often what it meant. You never see her again. Or you would see her very, very rarely, maybe once or twice in the next 30 years or something, hard to know. So very often it was understood that if this young man was moving from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel to marry this woman, he was going to have to live in Bavel, at least for many years, until the family got used to the idea that she's going to leave one day. But that's probably going to be a long time. They want to see a grandchild or two grandchildren, and in the meantime he has to set up a business. So he's going to be there a long time. It's going to be a while. He doesn't know exactly how long he's going to have to be there. He wants to come back, he intends to come back, but it's not going to happen overnight. So it's very likely to be a long, drawn-out absence in Eretz Yisrael, and nevertheless the halacha is allowed to go to Chutz La'aretz for this purpose, because getting married is a very, very essential and fundamental inyan, and it's worth paying the price of leaving Eretz Yisrael, even for a lengthy period of time. But nevertheless, the halacha is, it has to be on condition that he returns, says the Rambam. V'yachzor la'aretz, on condition that he will eventually return. In other words, it's a short-term loss to the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael, but not a permanent loss, or a medium-term loss, but not forever. It's not for keeps. The other example was lahasil miyada goyim, to save Jews from non-Jews. In other words, it's hard to know what that means. It's a very general expression, a very vague statement. It could be anything, really. In other words, if he's some kind of a politician or a lobbyist, and he, by going to Rome and lobbying senators in the Roman Senate or what have you, he can relax certain restrictions on the Jews, let's say in Eretz Yisrael. And we know for a fact that Chachamim did this. We have explicit statements where Rabbi Akiva is reported as having been in Rome. He didn't go there as a tourist. He went there because he was trying to... one of the things that certainly he was doing often, and other Chachamim, there's a Mishnah that talks about Rabban Gamliel and other Chachamim on a ship going to Rome and what they did on the way back, etc. They were going to speak as representatives of the Jewish people in Israel, who are under Roman occupation and under the thumb of the Roman Empire. And as we mentioned before, they weren't a nice bunch. And you had to sometimes go and lobby and request and beg that they leave the Jews alone or reduce taxes or whatever it was. And for that, that's mutar. That's called lahasil miyad ha-goyim, to save Jews from the goyim, to do something to help the Jewish people, the Jewish community, whether it's the Jewish community here in Eretz Yisrael, or the Jewish community over there in Rome, or wherever it may be. If it's for that kind of communal reason, in order to bring about salvation and relief to the Jewish people, or some large number of Jewish people, or a large number of individuals, that's a sufficiently powerful reason to leave Eretz Yisrael, even if you know in advance that you're going to have to spend 6 months or a year in Rome doing this, because, you know, until you get an appointment with the senator and what have you, it could be 3 months, and then maybe you may be put off and whatever. You don't know. Once you go on such a... You leave the country on for such a purpose, you cannot be certain when you're going to return. In those days, certainly, things didn't happen quickly. So the Chachamim recognized these things, as we said before. This miswa, like any miswa, like the entire Torah, is to be understood and is to be implemented and interpreted and lived according to sechel, according to human reason and logic and common sense. And it has to fit in with the realities. So if the reality is that this person, for whatever reason, is not going to be able to study Torah, at least not on the level that he requires, he's not going to find the right kind of person to teach him Torah, the kind of Torah that he wants or that he needs to learn. He learned up to a certain point and there's no one else left in the country. It's obviously a low period in the Jewish people's history if that's the case. But if there's no one left in the country who can teach him anything he doesn't know, but there are such people somewhere else outside the country, then he can go there in order to study Torah. That's a legitimate reason. Or lisa isha, or to get married also. You might ask, why didn't he get married to a woman here? Well, there could be many reasons why it didn't happen, but it didn't happen. But he knows if he goes there, or it's likely he has family there, it'll work out. So in these situations, he's allowed to leave the country. And again, it's for it can be a medium or fairly lengthy time, but it has to, on condition that he will return, but not permanently. If a person at the outset says, "I'm leaving the country permanently for good for this reason," then he's clearly contravening what the Chachamim said. He's not following this halacha. He's what he's doing is an avera. The only time the Rambam said it's mutar to pick up and leave with the intention of remaining in Chutz Laaretz, the Rambam said, is when the economic situation is so dire that one cannot really survive. As he says here, there's famine and everything is, the prices are skyrocketing and etc. If that's the situation, then it's mutar, because the Torah is not given in order that a person should live in Eretz Yisrael and die here, but rather they should live here, not die here. The reason I explained all this and I stressed all this is because I have heard certain rabbanim, and in this case we're talking about rabbanim of a particular stripe, of a particular hashkafa. In this case we're talking about the Dati Lumi world, Dafka, the so-called religious Zionist world, or however you wish to call it. I have heard certain rabbanim, I've heard this with my own ears, and I've also heard it reported to me by others, that in one case, for example, a person said to me when I was learning in Merkaz Harav many, many moons ago, this person's sister was getting married in the United States, and he was from America, and he was going back for the wedding, just for a week or 2 weeks or something. And he mentioned it to another Rabbanim, and this Rav raised eyebrows and said, doesn't say in the Rambam you can go back because your sister's getting married, so why are you allowed to go? Who said you're allowed to go back for 2 weeks for your sister's wedding? This understanding, in my view, is completely spurious. Turning Eretz Yisrael into some kind of a prison, where once you're here, you can't leave. You're stuck. There's nothing you can do. You can't go for any reason, unless it's exactly what it says here. Unless it's to learn Torah, or to get married yourself, or for business purposes, or something like that. You cannot leave. You can't step out, put your foot over the border. That's not what's being discussed here. To make a short trip, a fixed, limited time trip to Chutz La'aretz, whether it's to go to your sister's wedding, or to visit your aging parents, or just to visit your parents. They don't have to be aging. They don't have to be very old, and they can be perfectly healthy, and everything's fine. But they haven't seen you in 12 months, and they want to see you. They want to see you, maybe your wife in the meantime you got married. They want to see your child, perhaps, or they just want to see you. It's vaday mutar to go to Chutz La'aretz, to visit family, to in fact, it's mutar for any reason, basically. Even as it says in the Gemara Moed Katan, I'm not going to go into it now, but the Gemara says explicitly in Masechet Moed Katan that even a person who's wealthy is allowed to go to Chutz La'aretz on a business trip to make even more money. In other words, you don't have to be poor, you don't have to be needy. Business is commerce, business, etc., is a legitimate pursuit. If you're going on a business trip, as we said before, a one-day trip or a one-week trip or a one-month trip, that's not considered a long-term arrangement. That's something that's mutar. Always. If it's mutar for a very rich man who's got 15 million in the bank to go to Chutz La'aretz for 3 weeks in order to make another million, and that's mufurash in the Gemara, that it's mutar to do so, then I think it's kal v'chomer, it's mutar for a stammer, average Jew to go visit his parents in Atlanta, Georgia. That's, I think it's pashut. Don't you know? We have someone from Georgia right here, so there you go. I think it's self-evident that it's so. Or alternately, to go back to that example, to go for 2 weeks to be at your sister's wedding, to be part of the simcha, to be there for the sheva brachot, whatever it is. I think it's clear that that's mutar. It's not nothing. None of this is included in what the Chachamim had in mind here. What the Chachamim had in mind here was a long-term absence from Eretz Yisrael. In other words, picking up and moving for a period of many, many months or years or many years. And even that is mutaran if it's for certain reasons, as we saw. And therefore, it's not surprising, on the very same Amud, in Masechet Ketubot, Daf Kof Yod Amud Beth, that we find these two halachot, the halacha about one spouse forcing the other to move to Eretz Yisrael, or one preventing the other from leaving Eretz Yisrael, we find on the very same Amud, the well-known Baraita, something also again that the Rambam quotes. It says, "Tanora banan be'olam yadur adam be'eretz Yisrael." A Jew should always do his utmost to live in Eretz Yisrael. As we said before, there are circumstances and there are reasons and there are times in history and circumstances where it's not possible, or it's extremely risky. In which case, you don't have to, or you maybe even shouldn't do it, depending on the level of risk involved. But most things being equal, and again, by the way, travel always involves some danger. Any travel involves danger. Getting on a bus to Tel Aviv also involves some danger. But we can't live our lives in such a fashion. Then you wouldn't cross the street, and you wouldn't go to the Makola to buy a bag of milk if you looked at reality and existence in that fashion. So everything involves some risk. The question is how much risk. If it's something that people do normally as a matter of course, then it's apparently not such a terribly risky business, right? Jumping off a bridge with a bungee rope attached to your ankles might be considered by some people, and maybe they're right, as a very risky business. And some people have been killed doing that sort of thing. Although probably most don't, I don't know. But I imagine that most of the time you survive. But sometimes accidents have happened. You're asking for trouble, let's put it that way. But taking a trip even across the ocean on a plane today is a very, very unremarkable event, as we all know. So when the Braitha here says, having discussed all these issues, it says the bottom line is le'olam yadur adam be'eretz Yisrael, a person should always do his utmost to live in Eretz Yisrael, afilu be'ir shirubah goyim, That's, of course, in this sense, the text of the Talmud Bavli that I have in front of me, Tfus Vilas is, of course, of the Kochavim, but which is, of course, an act of censorship. The Rambam, which is easy to prove, I have here the first printing of the Talmud Bavli. In the printed version, you can see the correct Nusach, but I'll read just from the Rambam, that will be sufficient. The Rambam says, at the end of this perek, Halacha Tethwa, Le'olam yadur adam be'eretz Yisrael, afilu be'ir shiruba goyim, even if it means moving from Chutz La'aretz, from a great center of Torah and Jewish existence where you have millions of Jews, like New York City. There were times in history, as I understand, that there was actually a majority of the people living in New York were actually Jews. No problem. Well, I don't know. Again, I suppose it depends exactly how you define the borders, but maybe the five boroughs or something, I'm not sure. But I understand that historically, maybe in the 40s and the 30s, the 50s maybe still, maybe it was 50%. It's a huge number, all right? You could definitely say at some time today it's lesser, I think. But there were times when you could say, and then the past about New York, shall we say, in the recent history, in more ancient history, that was true about Bavel. There were parts of Bavel during the time of the Mishnah, the time of the Talmud, where areas in Bavel, towns and whole regions, where the majority of the people were Jewish, or 50%. Right. I understand there were a million Jews in Warsaw before the war, or something like that. So I understand, which is a phenomenal number. And I'm not sure exactly how many people lived in Warsaw altogether before the Second World War, but it can't have been many, many times that number. It only can have been a few times that number, I imagine, at most. So even if you're moving from an area, so says the Braitha, so say Chazal, so says the Rambam. Even if you're moving from an area where it's a great center of Jewish culture and learning and Torah and what have you, and you move to Eretz Yisrael, or you wish to move to Eretz Yisrael, even if it means living in an area which is mainly inhabited by non-Jews, and even they're pagans and whatever does that are, etc., etc., nevertheless, you should do so. And that's a statement that should make a person sit up and think. Right? It's something that you should really think about. You're being told here that even though you're living here in Nahar Da'ah, in Bavel, if you take it to the time of the Chachamim, and everything's fine here, there's not lacking anything, there's lots of kosher meat, and there's lots of mikvaoth, and there's lots of yeshivoth, and there's lots of Jews, and the Jews are allowed to live in peace, and they're unmolested, and that was true for a very long period of time. Nevertheless, the Chachamim, let it be known, it's always preferable to get up and move to Eretz Yisrael, even though the conditions there are much less favorable in many, many ways. Shekola Yosef Yehusar Ares Kilo Aved Avodah Zarah Shenema Ki Gershuni Yom Yistapach Nachrat Hashem Lomar Lech Avod Elohim Aherim. This is a quote from Shmuel, and this is quoted, this is all from the Braitha here in Masechet Shabbat, Masechet Ketubot. So if Chazal made such a statement that or it says here, Shekol Adar Be'eretz Yisrael Domeh K'mishi Yesh Lo Eloha. In other words, it's as if he's announcing, he's confirming that he has a connection to Hashem Elohei Yisrael. And he who chooses to live in Chutz La'aretz when he can do otherwise, it's as if basically he's announcing for all to know and to hear and to understand that his connection to Hashem is not very great, not very meaningful. If Chazal made such a statement, then we are to take it very, very seriously indeed. These are not Divrei Agadah. If it was Divrei Agadah, then you can always say it's an exaggeration, or it's not to be taken literally, or it's a mashal. But this is not a mashal. This is a practical halachic issue. It's written here in the Rambam as a practical halachic statement. Just to round out this discussion, I just want to mention that I mentioned the Rambam many times, but it's not as if the Rambam brings these halachot. That's entirely untrue. The Tur and the Shulchan Aruch in Ibn Ezer, Siman Ayin He, bring all these halachot. The halacha about spouses forcing one another to move to Eretz Yisrael says here in Siman Ayin He in Ibn Ezer, in the Shulchan Aruch, in Seif Gimel, it says, "Mihutz la'aretz Eretz Yisrael kofim otha la'alot afilu minaweh yafa lenaweh ra'." Even from a very nice area, a nice house, a nice place, a nice neighborhood, to a place in Eretz Yisrael which is much less pleasant, ואפילו ממקום שרובו ישראל למקום שרובו גויים אין מוסעים מארץ ישראל לחוץ לארץ ואפילו, etc. Now, there was the whole halakha, all the details that we discussed, I mentioned here explicitly in the Torah, in the Shulchan Aruch. And also the Rashbash that we mentioned is also quoted by the Shulchan Aruch in Seif Hei. In other words, he says here, at the end of the Siman, the Shulchan Aruch, Yesh mi she'omer, Daha dekofim la'aloth Eretz Yisrael, Hainu b'de'efshar b'lo sakana. And then he gives some of the details that the Rashbash discusses. In other words, from what part of the world to Eretz Yisrael is it considered not very risky, and from what parts of the world is it considered more risky. This is also quoted, this Rashbash is the source for this halakha, the Shulchan Aruch. So, It's not a lone opinion of one Rishon, even if it's just the Rambam, so to speak. It's an opinion which is accepted and understood by all the major posukim. All the posukim agree and admit and state freely and without in a totally unambiguous way that this Mishnah, this Halakha, and all the related Halakhoth refer to. Apply to all periods of Jewish history. In other words, the issue of sakana aside, but this Mishnah was not stated only for the period when the Beit Mikdash stands. It's not connected to the Beit Mikdash. It's not connected to who rules Eretz Yisrael, doesn't rule Eretz Yisrael. At all times, in all periods of history, when it's possible, these halachot apply. This is the halacha lemaaseh, the opinion of all the major posukim. Alright, are there any questions?
Am I correct to say that there's two opinions about when they give the reasons for leaving marriage and Limud Torah? Some say only those reasons you can leave Eretz Yisrael, and some maintain those are examples, but any other mitzvot, you know, you can leave also to do other mitzvot.
For example, what kind of mitzvah? For example, what kind of mitzvah?
Other mitzvahs, I don't know. They probably specify other mitzvot. Like
I'm willing to accept the argument that these are major examples, and one can extrapolate from them certain other cases as well. Mm-hmm. But you cannot say that it applies to any miswa, for example, and obviously these all these issues which Chazal mentioned, in other words, to get married or to study Torah, etc., which are all major miswa, very important things. But why do they choose these particular ones? They could have chosen the miswa of lulav or eating masa or something. But that's not the case, because first of all, it's unusually not the case that you can't find lulav in Eretz Yisrael, which you will be able to elsewhere. And it's similarly unlikely to be the case that you won't have masa to eat in Eretz Yisrael, but you will find it in some other country. But more than that, we're talking about miswath, which by definition, as I explained before, usually involve a lengthy absence from Eretz Yisrael. Right? I think it is true, but not just for the reason that it's a miswath, but because, as I said, any short-term absence from Eretz Yisrael is mutar anyhow. In other words, it's mutar... To go visit a friend or to make more money, even if you have lots of money. So therefore, if it's not very unlikely, I know, but if it were a fact that a person knew, you know, it's going to be Sukkot in 2 days' time, and there's no lulavim in Eretz Yisrael, there's no etrogim in Eretz Yisrael, but in, I don't know, in Poland there are plenty, right? Not likely, but let's just say. Well, it would have been mutar for him to go to Poland so be able to do the miswal lulav if he happens to have the money to go there. He's not required to travel to Poland and put out the money, etc., to do this. But let's say he wants to, or he has other reasons to travel in that direction, so he can make a stop in Warsaw and sit there, stay there for the week of Sukkot or whatever. Of course, it's a ridiculous, it's an absurd hypothetical situation, but even if that were the case, yes, of course it would be mutar to go for that reason, for a week, for a few days, for an hour, whatever it was. But these are miswath, the Chachamim discussed, these are realities that by the very nature of what they are, are always involve a lengthy stay in Chutz Laretz, even sometimes many years. If there are other examples that someone can come up with, of other very, very important causes and issues that may require a Jew to live in Chutz Laretz for, let's say, a number of years for a very important cause, then I think the same would apply. Yes, I can think of an example actually. Now that you mention it, I actually know such a person. I won't mention him by name, but there's a certain political organization in Eretz Yisrael known as today as Manhigut Yehudit, which is, some of you may know, is involved in the Likud and trying to work their way into the Likud and make themselves cause themselves to be to exist in the corridors of power within the Likud and therefore in government, etc. And I hope they succeed. So if a person, for example, is sent to North America for a number of years even, or open-ended, we don't know. We need you to go and raise money for this purpose. We consider this, we know this to be a very important thing, or we believe it's a very important thing. It's a great cause the Jewish people require. And we need you because you're an expert and you know how to do it. You've proved yourself in this field before. We need you to go to America and raise money until we tell you we don't need you. We don't know for how long. It could be 2 years, it could be 10 years. We need you to go to the U.S. and live there and take your family with you and raise money and do whatever has to be done. That's a job. That's a hefty job description. Is it mutar? I would say yes, it's mutar. And as it happens, I know exactly such a person who did this. And he was there for quite a number of years, and he only recently moved back to Eretz Israel. All right? That's a reality. And I think in fact, I think it probably falls precisely into another category actually mentioned explicitly by the Rambam, that is lahasil minagoyim, right? To save Jews, in other words, to bring about some betterment of the position or the reality of the Jews. I think that actually fits into that category. But anything which can be reasonably compared to those examples, I think also the halacha the same would apply. That's the way of halacha in general. That medamim milta lemilta, we compare one case to another. If the comparison is reasonable, if it sticks, then that same halacha would apply. One more question?
Yes, sir.
The question that I wanted to ask was this idea of being that it's a sort to put oneself in danger. I think that probably this was one of the many reasons and one of the many things said about why, I guess the majority of Rabbanim in Europe didn't get involved in coming to Eretz Israel and certainly were opposed to the Zionist movement and so on and so forth. I think that probably seems, even among some of the Haredi rabbis, they had certain concepts like Yad Yisrael Takifa and so on and so forth, but they had an opposite concept, that it's a sort of stakein, you can't put yourself in danger. And so it was like, well, as soon as you get the upper hand and suddenly you're sovereign, or the Jewish people are sovereign, then all these halachot applied. But until that happens, it's a sort to actually make it happen, because you're putting yourself and everyone else in danger. So it seems like kind of put two halachot against each other, and then the answer given by most rabbanim was just, well, then don't do anything. So I was wondering what you thought about that.
Well, one of the reasons many Jews, huge numbers of Jews, left Russia at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, was because of the ever-increasing danger to Jews in Russia. There were the pogroms, etc., were increasing in frequency and in scale and scope, etc. And precisely for this reason, many Jews left Russia, and many went to North America and some to other parts of the world. So you see that when the scales begin to tip or things tend to equalize, there's danger here, there's danger in staying, there's danger in traveling. So then really there's no point discussing sakana now, because there's sakana wherever you turn, all right? And that's practically what happened, and that also strengthens what we said before, that in many periods of history it was perceived, rightly or wrongly, you could say, that
by many Jews that it's safer, even though the situation where we are is not maybe that congenial in every way, but it's safer to stay put where we are and live with the devil you know, rather than take upon ourselves this trip in all kinds of impossible or unknowable conditions. And who knows what where we'll end up, and if we'll get there, and what we'll find when we get there, etc. You have to remember, people didn't know. A Jew living in Germany in the year 1200 didn't know what was really going on there at Israel. Didn't have a very clear idea. He couldn't really know, and it was a very big question mark. There were many Jews also felt this in Europe in the 1930s. There were dangers. There was increasing tension. There were reasons to be worried, and many certain Jews at least saw the writing on the wall, but others felt it was safer to stay put. Now we know historically that staying put was not the right choice, correct? So, of course, you can overplay the issue of sakana. You can overplay the consideration of the dangers involved in travel, etc. But again, in the modern world, these dangers have been reduced to such an extent that it's really not in any way a discussion that can be compared to what was once the case. And we know that practically those Jews who picked up and left, shall we say, in the 1930s from different parts of Europe when it was still possible to do so, they usually survived. And most of those who did not survive. So, sakana is a consideration, but it can't be the only consideration. It also has to be looked at in a realistic manner. I think it's also possible to add that once you have a situation, a reality in which a majority of the Jewish people are living in different countries all over the globe, really, shall we say, the situation before the Zionist movement, or when the Zionist movement began, which is over 100 years ago. And if we were to agree that at that time it was still a very risky business to travel to Eretz Yisrael from different parts of the world, I think it was much less hazardous by that time. By that time, the late 19th century, it was much, much less of a risk to take a journey. But even if you were to claim that it was so, it's also nevertheless a fact that unless you were to find some Jews, a certain minimum number of Jews, like a critical mass of Jews, willing to take even great risks to come to Eretz Yisrael and start the ball rolling again. In other words, get the Jewish people moving again in this direction of moving from Chutz Laaretz to Eretz Yisrael, and picking up and leaving and making moving to Eretz Yisrael a reality that other people see that it can be done. You know, he did it and so-and-so did it, so maybe we'll also think about it. Unless you have those Nachshonim, like Nachshon ben Aminadav jumped into the water, right? At Yam Suf, when people were scared that the water was still there, and they were told, once you get in, it'll dry up, it'll split, but in the meantime, you have to jump into the water and get wet. And not everyone's willing to get wet, but you need someone who is willing to get wet. If you didn't have those Jews who were willing to come here at great risk to themselves, and let us not forget there were people who came to Eretz Israel 150 years ago and more recently, 90 years ago, and they came to parts of the country where there were swamps full of mosquitoes which gave you malaria, and people came and people died. Some people came and lost their family. Their wife and their children died as a result of malaria, because they chose to come here. But if there hadn't been such Jews willing to do that, then it's almost a certainty that we wouldn't be here today. In other words, when the situation has spun so far out of control, as our situation as a nation had spun out of control down to 100 or more years ago, you need extraordinary measures. You need to think out of the box, and in other words, out of the halachic box. In other words, even if the normal halacha states that if it's very risky, you don't have to do it, or maybe you shouldn't do it, sometimes you need to ignore that regular, that standard halacha, in order to bring about a major change in the Jewish people's
national existence, shall we say. And there are many other examples where the halakha is stated for the average case, for the average person, an average time. But in particular times in history, particular junctures in history, where special action is required, so those rules perhaps don't apply. And we see in reality that's exactly what happened. It's only because certain Jews over the last, shall we say, 250 years or so, roughly, were willing to brave all the dangers and the tribulations involved in coming here, that when, for instance, as I think I mentioned last week also, when the Zionist movement actually got off the ground and started speaking in realistic terms about bringing many Jews to Eretz Yisrael and setting up a Jewish state in Eretz Yisrael, they weren't it was not something yesh me'ayin. It was not talking about something that had to be invented from scratch. The wheel had already been invented. They didn't have to reinvent the wheel. There already were a significant number of Jews in Eretz Yisrael. There already was a Jewish presence, a significant Jewish presence. For the first time in who knows how long, there was a very significant Jewish presence in Eretz Yisrael. So even the Zionists, who didn't like the kinds of Jews they found here, they didn't like certain things whatever it was, had a different philosophy and a different approach and a different agenda altogether, but there were Jews here. That's why they were able to come. So, as I said before, that not every Jew can be a hero, but you need heroes, right? Not every soldier in an army, you can't demand of every soldier to be a hero. But someone's always going to be a hero. There's always going to be heroes. Because without a few heroes who are willing to risk their lives, literally, then you won't make it. A simple example is well known. I mean, this is true of any war, in any battle, really. But it's well known D-Day, when the Allies landed on the beaches in Normandy. The first troops who had to land on the beach, and there were, as I recall, from what I remember, there were U.S. Rangers. Had to scale the cliffs on ropes, etc., to get etc. And of course the Germans were waiting on top, and they were shooting at them. If there weren't heroes willing to do that, then the beachhead may never have happened. And if that didn't happen, then who knows what would have happened? In other words, there always are heroes. That's also, in other words, it's part of reality that certain people do things that are unreal. It's part of the normal way of things that certain people do things that are not normal, that are beyond the normal bounds of human endeavor. And that's probably, almost certainly, I think, the case when it comes to this issue as well. When the situation is seemingly beyond redemption, you need to have very special people and very special, with special motivation and almost limitless self-sacrifice in order to put things back on track. These halachot were not discussing necessarily such a situation. We were talking about a situation, shall we say, where you had X number of Jews in Eretz Yisrael, a large number, and another Y number of Jews in Bavel, a large number also, maybe a larger number. And the question is, if a woman in Bavel said to her husband, I want to go to Eretz Yisrael, what do you do? But it wasn't necessarily talking about some extreme reality. But the Jewish people's reality 200 years ago or 100 years ago was very extreme. All right, we'll leave it at that for tonight. Kol tov.